Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Dog lovers, pay heed. You too, art lovers, or anyone looking for a very cool place to visit in Vermont. Today, we're headed to St. Johnsbury and up to Dog Mountain. Oh, yes, dogs very much welcome, and they love dashing about the mountain as if they've found the canine heaven on earth. It's a special place created by a special Vermonter who once had a very special dog. But I'm not the person to tell that story. Joining me for that is Pam McCann, General Manager at Dog Mountain. Pam, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Pam a question about Dog Mountain, or if your pooch wants to relate a story of a recent visit there, bow wow, put them on the phone. You can call us at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Pam, I'm not sure if I should start from the dogs or the humans' perspective, but why don't you give us one big overview of what Dog Mountain is?
Okay. Well, Dog Mountain is a treasure of a place. It's really a sanctuary for humans and dogs, and it was created by Stephen Hunick and his wife, Gwen. And Stephen was an internationally renowned folk artist. He came to his notoriety by making the sculpture of an angel. And he was quickly noticed and sort of had a lucky break. But he really became known for his dog art. And that was based on their dog, Sally, who became the poster child for a lot of that work. And the Hunicks were dog lovers. They didn't have children, but they really, really were tied in and closely connected to their dogs and wanted to create a place to celebrate that connection. And they bought some land in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, and bought a home there. They lived a couple of miles up the road from the mountain, and they renovated an old farm and created a 150-acre dog park with a mile and a half of walking trails, or hiking trails. Down below, there's beautiful fields and vistas. There's a dog swimming pond, an agility course, and it's just a place to come and have peace and have a picnic. And they turned the farmhouse into one of Stephen's galleries. Stephen had many galleries across the nation at one point. And the big barn into Stephen's production studios, where they made sculpture and fine furniture. And Stephen was a printmaker and also the author of what became known as the Sally books, which a generation of kids grew up with. And yeah, those were a lot of fun. So he was a very prolific guy, and Gwen had a lot of input on his ideas, and she did a lot of painting. So the colors of the art really reflect her taste and ideas. And so the biggest and most personal work, as Stephen calls it, is something called the Dog Chapel.
Yes, and we'll get to that.
Mountain.
Oh, and
yeah,
it's incredible. Before we get to that, because it is a special place on a special place, what was Steve and Gwen's dream for Dog Mountain?
I think their dream for Dog Mountain, as I sort of touched on, was to have a place where people could come with their dogs. It's a leashless and fenceless mountain. There aren't the kind of restrictions that you have when you go to your typical dog park. They wanted it to be really out in nature, so people could just experience that with their dogs, you know, running free. And that was the idea behind the dog park segment. And, of course, on the land are the gallery and the chapel, but really just a place for people to come commune with their animals and with nature. Mm-hmm. And that was their vision for that. And they wanted it to be open to people. They didn't want to charge. They wanted it to be free, so always people in the community and beyond could come in and just enjoy the beauty of the land.
Why was Sally so important to Stephen?
I think, they had many dogs. And I don't know, I think that the first sculpture that Stephen did was a relief called Life is a Ball, and it featured Sally, swimming with the ball. Mm-hmm. And from there, she just became the poster child. And you know, little trivia is the first Sally was actually a male. And his name was Salvador Doggy. And so, but Sally for short. And then, you know, consecutive dogs after that were Sally females. But in any case, I think it just sort of was by default and it just happened. And it wasn't that, you know, Sally was any more special than their other dogs, of course. It's just that she ended up on the first bit of artwork that he put out there and the Black Lab became what he was known for.
Yeah. Who owns and operates Dog Mountain now?
Well, it's now owned and operated by a nonprofit group called the Friends of Dog Mountain. And it was a long climb to get to that status, but they've been in control for about 2.5, maybe 3 years now. And it's a great group, and thank goodness for them, and thank goodness for the Ide family, who is Gwen Hunick's family, for working with them and keeping the faith to keep it going. So now it is fully owned by the group, and with great things ahead, and working on a lot of interesting things right now.
I remember Stephen once telling a story about when he moved here to Vermont, going around and getting old furniture and restoring it. We sometimes forget that he has created some incredible furniture. It's some of the most creative and whimsical I've ever seen. Can you describe some of the pieces that he's made?
Yes. There's a lot of fun things in the gallery still. Unfortunately, not a lot of it is available anymore, but it's certainly on display. You know, he had a lot of interests. He had interest in fishing. He also, some of his earlier work depicted his experience in parochial school. So we've got a set of twin nuns, which are a liquor cabinet, which is really funny. We also have this Seti trout seat, which is really, you know, a centerpiece in the gallery. I always try to keep it right out in the middle of the floor. People love that. Mm-hmm. And he also did this whole series of rocket ship furniture. There's a rocket ship chair in the gallery, and he did whole bedroom sets of that. He had kind of a broad range of things that he dealt with, you know. And yes, the furniture is beautiful. And he collected old antique furniture, and he just found, you know, elements of it that he loved and brought a lot of that into his own work. There's a lot of Shaker influence in his work, but then he just, you know, twisted it with his own whimsy and made these pieces that were incredible. And there was also a lot of Egyptian influence, believe it or not, and that came from Gwen's interest. So some of the pieces that you see that are kind of more eclectic have that influence. So that's what you can find and more.
Yeah, and wonderful prints, but don't forget to check out Stephen's furniture when you go to Dog Mountain in St. Jay. All right, so let's talk about the dogs. When dogs get out to visit the mountain, what can they do?
Anything they want.
Exactly.
You know, yes, they are free to wander. You know, we do require a leash in the gallery at this point. Mm-hmm. It can get a little wild in there with a lot of dogs and people, so dogs have to be on leash in the gallery. But they just can come up there and run around and go swimming in the pond. And depending on your dog's level of, you know, recall knowledge as far as, you know, callback, whatever, you can just choose whether you leash your dog or not. And they are just really just free to go anywhere they want and run around. And if your dog's into agility course or wants to have a try at that, they could do that. Hike the trails. You know, there's 1.5 miles of hiking trails, and we keep water around for the dogs. You can wash your dog off, a little doggy washing station in front of the gallery, and just fun. And there's a great vibe up there, and the dogs really feel it, even if they've never been there. And everybody comments on it, literally everyone, when they come up, that their dog just kind of started smiling and getting happy and knowing that something was going to happen.
Pam, you've hit it right on the head. When I was up there once and Stephen was around, I was so worried that dogs would fight with each other, right? And I said, right? Don't you have a problem with that? He said, never. Right? The dogs,
it's
just
true.
Yeah.
It's really true. It's very rare. You know, they might have a little bit of a, hey, who are you? You know, but never. We do not have that issue. And it's really kind of, it's a little woo-woo, you know. they know, and they just have fun. And I think that because they're not they don't have the limitations. They just figure it out themselves. There's no leashes. There's no fences. There's nobody calling them back every 5 seconds. There's not that level of kind of nervousness that can happen, you know, that the humans impose. You know, the dogs can figure it out themselves. And they have fun. They find friends, and they socialize, and they run around together, and they play. And it's just a whole social setting for them.
It is canine heaven on earth, as I mentioned at the beginning. Now, Pam, I know you wanted to tell us all about the dog chapel before. Now we're ready. One of my favorite spots in the whole state. What's the story, first of all, behind the dog chapel?
Yes, the story behind the dog chapel is very poignant, actually. Stephen had a fall on stairs, and he had an accident and ended up in the hospital and went into a coma for about 3 months. He really was not expected to survive the incident, but he did. His wife, Gwen, was by his side every single day. She was playing him his Indian drum music, and really just, I think that she was very instrumental in bringing him back. And so he came out of his coma. He was very impaired. He couldn't walk. He couldn't move, really. He couldn't do anything. He had to relearn everything. And while he was in his coma, he attributes it to being in his coma anyway, an epiphanous dream or thought that he would build something called a dog chapel. And he was very connected to his dogs, and the dogs had a lot to do with his recovery. He really attributed the therapeutic value of his dogs to that recovery and the pace of it and how he was able to do it. And they'd lost some dogs along the way. And Stephen really thought there's really no place where people can come and celebrate that bond after their dogs pass, even while they're alive, to just come and have a celebratory place to hang out and think and maybe write a little note. That was his next thought. He created a wall inside this chapel that he decided to build. And the style of the chapel is a New England style small chapel. It's beautiful. It fits in the landscape. He built a foam core wall to the left when you walk inside the chapel for people to maybe put a little note written to their dog in remembrance. And that kind of took on its own life. And the dog chapel walls began to get filled up. And it's just a beautiful place of memorial there. And it's not permanent memorial. It's just a place to write a note and say your goodbye or just have thoughts and sit on the beautiful carved pews that are, you know, bookended by black lab dog head and torsos. It's just gorgeous. And stained glass windows that have a dog theme. It's just beautiful. There's no dogmas allowed there, as the sign says. It's not a place that depicts any religion or anything. It just happens to be that the shape of the place is that of a New England small chapel. And it is beautiful and poignant, and people come from all over the world and make pilgrimages to go there and say their goodbyes to their beloved dogs. And that's what it is, and it's really magical. And the I think the best part of the chapel, being there working in the galleries, when people come in after having been there and all pretense is dropped, everyone is really real and in their raw space and emotional, and they will just meet you on their true ground, who they really are. Everything's dropped, and tell you about their dog, about their life, and you really get into deep conversations with people because of the chapel. And recently, I have to say, the steeple was restored, and the Golden Angel dog, which had fallen off some years ago, was restored and replaced. Oh, and we're going to be celebrating that in a big way in the fall. So it's really it's the only one in the world. It's highly unique. All of the elements of Dog Mountain are highly unique. Yeah. And the chapel is the centerpiece of that. So,
absolutely.
That's the short story, even though it sounds as long.
All right, Pam, hey, let's take a call. We've got Nancy joining us from Morrisville. Hi, Nancy. Go right ahead.
Good morning, and thank you. I have been to Dog Mountain with my husband This is a wonderful presentation, by the way. I can't believe the talent there between him and Glenn. I mean, artful, witty, peaceful, playful, reverent, inspiring. I mean, such talent, and too bad they're not still there.
Right.
And by the way, we did post our own memorial note. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Nancy. Yeah, you must hear that all the time, Pam, when people
all
come up.
All the time.
And, yeah.
All the time. And thank you so much, Nancy. You know, it's just, it's real.
It is real.
It's all real. And you can hear it in her voice, in your voice, Nancy. You know, it's really special.
Well, let's talk about some events that you've got scheduled coming up there. I think you've got a big one this Saturday with the VSO.
We do. The VSO is coming on Saturday, the 10th, which we're excited about, and that's the quartet. And they will be at the Mountain. And I wish I had the time in front of me. I don't. I think it's maybe around 3 o'clock. Sorry about that. But you can visit our website at dogmt.com to find out. And then the following day, on Sunday, the Levitt Amp concert series begins. And we do that in partnership with Catamount Arts in St. Johnsbury. Catamount is amazing, and they do all sorts of things throughout the region, and we partner with them, and we have been so lucky because of our supporters, Catamount's and ours, to win the voting grant, which is highly competitive. It's a national voting grant for the Levitt Amp concert series, and this will actually be our fourth year presenting this. We couldn't do it last year, obviously. So everyone's very excited that it's back. It's free and dog-friendly. There's a large mobile stage down at the bottom of a natural amphitheater. And there's the Kingdom Tap Room from here in St. Johnsbury in partnership with them. They provide some adult beverages. We have food trucks, lovely vendors, and it's just a great time. So a doubleheader this weekend.
That's so great.
The VSO and Levitt Amp. And we've got the Levitt Amp series is 10 shows. They're on Sundays. As I said, they're free and dog friendly. They begin like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and go till 8 p.m. And then some other things scattered in between that. We've got another dog party coming up, our summer dog party and our fall dog party.
Yeah, let's talk about those. We played Tommy Cooper's How Come There's No Dog Day. And years ago, Stephen insisted that I had to attend one of his dog parties. I am so glad
really?
I did. Yeah. Even though I didn't have a dog, he made sure I came up. So tell us about the summer party, what happens, and when that'll be.
Definitely. And I'm glad you mentioned that because you don't need a dog to come to Dog Mountain. You can come and live vicariously, you know, and they're dog human parties. So come on up. But, the dog parties are really just carrying on a tradition, I guess, that Stephen and Gwen started by having these dog parties and inviting people to come, you know, maybe for a small at first they started at their home, as a barbecue, you know, run with your dogs, come and hang out. And then they moved it to the Mountain and, the dog parties took on a larger life. And, basically, you know, fun for the family, music, discounts on the art in the gallery, dog contests are the centerpiece of it, food truck, you know, vendor. We've got, you just come in and hike the grounds and hang out. And, I think the next parties are going to have a few different elements. So I'm working on that because I'm the events coordinator there. So maybe there'll be some new elements. But it's just a day to really come, celebrate your dog. It's dog day at Dog Mountain every day.
Yeah.
The dog parties are special. Our first party was a great success, and that's our Founders Day party, which really celebrates Gwen and Stephen and them, putting all of this together for all of us to still enjoy. And it's just a heap of fun. You know, I think we'll have a bounce house again at this one now that COVID is sort of waned in our part of the world, thankfully.
Right.
So a bounce house, you know, food vendor. We've got making maple syrup by Chris Parker. He makes sugar on snow and, you know, maple cotton candy and treats for the dogs. And the dog contests are hilarious and fun. And, you know, come and participate. You know, best kisser, best hugger, biggest and smallest dog look alike, human dog look alike. Super fun. And the dogs and everybody who comes really make the party. You know, it's whoever comes there just creating the party, really. And the mountain is just open. and that's kind of how it rolls. And
it's pretty great. There will be a summer one. There's one in October for the 20th anniversary dog party. We've got about a minute left, Pam. But what is it that you enjoy most about being up there on Dog Mountain?
Oh, God, everything. I mean, the setting, people, the dogs. The whole notion that you can dream without limits, which is Stephen's expression, that anything can happen and anything goes. And our dogs really help us, you know, to realize our inner healing potential. And I'm going beyond, but what I love about it is every morning for me when I drive up, it's like breathing a sigh of relief. It never gets old. Every season is gorgeous and beautiful. And I just love it there. And being surrounded by the artwork is incredible every single day. It's happy. It's whimsy and wisdom, you know. And it just sort of permeates you. So the best part for me is just that message that I get every single day. Just driving up, breathing the air, being, you know, having... being surrounded by beautiful artwork and furniture is an incredible gift.
So it's a place of joy. It's a place of love. And it is a perfect place for dogs.
It's the place. It's doggy nirvana.
It is doggy nirvana. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Pam McCann is the general manager at Dog Mountain. To learn more about visiting, about the art of Stephen Hunick, go to dogmt.com. Pam, thanks for joining us this morning. And give our best to the dogs.
Oh, thanks so much, Rick. Come see us again soon, okay?
I promise. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to open up the phones for the first time this week. And a reminder that today at noon, we've got the Midday News Service followed by the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's at 1 o'clock. This is Vermont Viewpoint at WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Oh, yeah, those ants are marching. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingary. Phones are open until 10 now, so hop on, 244-1777, 877-291-TALK. That's 877-291-8255, our toll-free number. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Your choice of subjects, but you can also, let's see, let us know how you spent the 4th of July and when. The 3rd, the 4th, the 5th, or do you love America so much all 3 days? That would be great. What does the 4th mean to you? You can tell us. Do you remember back to the bicentennial? Anybody? That whole year was a magic 4th of July celebration. And think about this. In just 5 years, we'll be celebrating the, let me try to get this right, the semi-quincentennial. The semi-quincentennial. The 250th anniversary of the country coming up in just a few years. Have we started making plans for this yet? How should we celebrate the semi-quincentennial? Use that at your next dinner party. Throw that word out there. Yeah, anybody making plans yet for the semi-quincentennial? Yeah, blow them away. All right, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I was down at Fenway last Thursday for the Sox day game, 15-1 pummeling of the Royals. I'll share some of that with you. But how has it felt for you getting back out, being with friends, being in crowds, being at restaurants, or are you still a little reticent? Love to know what you're thinking. I mean, Vermont has now, I think, over 82% vaccinated, so it's safer here than probably any place else on Earth. But are you still a little worried? Let us know, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Speaking of the socks, I want to mention a bunch of things we've got given away. First of all, we just heard Greg Hooker talking about the McKenzie Summer Grilling Package. The worst thing about working at WDEV is that we're not eligible to win that McKenzie meat package. And I really miss in past years when Greg Hooker would say on the commercial, "Hot diggity dog." I really wish they'd bring that back just for me. I love when he used to say that. But anyway, that's Fridays during the getaway. Be listening for the McKenzie Summer Grilling Package. As I mentioned, Sox tickets, and I think they're a little more random, although I could be wrong, but that's pretty great. We've sent some people down. As a matter of fact, there were winners from WDEV down at that game that I was at Thursday, 15-1 win. So we've got some good mojo. I think so far we've sent to the Yankees game and to the Royals game, and DEV fans are 2-0 at Fenway. And we've got Mountaineers tickets we're giving away a lot of. Tonight is WDEV night at the Mountaineers in Montpelier down at the rec field. And, boy, since 2003, now they had the year off, of course, last year, but since 2003, great summer college baseball, always competitive, always fun, just so a perfect family atmosphere going on there. So if you've never been to a Mountaineers game, so worth it's perfect Vermont. Summer baseball, you know, at that nice slow pace, just like it should be in the summer. And then don't forget on Tuesdays, although I think we moved this week's back to today, the state parks passes that are given out. So Tuesday is no longer Tuesday on WDEV. It's state park passes day. And that's a great thing to win, too. We spoke to the folks from the state parks a few weeks ago, and there are some wonderful state parks to see and to go jump in under falls and things like that throughout the state. So, all right, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We're going to head to Eden and talk to Brian. Hey, Brian, what's going on?
Well, I got a list here.
Okay.
Back to 76, 1976.
Yeah.
Everyone rang the church bells at noon. I remember that.
Oh, yeah.
All over the place.
What a year. What a time that was.
I got a list here called Vermont Problems.
Okay.
These are in no particular order.
All right. How long is the list, Brian?
It's pretty short.
Okay.
I can shorten it even.
No. Have fun.
But number one is sprayed by a skunk, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
No particular order here.
All right.
Flatlander hunters mistakenly shooting a Buick thinking it's a buck.
That's at least once a season, right?
The loon roast got canceled. That's political correctness right there.
Oh,
cancel
no.
culture. not understanding the function of a toll booth when you travel out of state. You just have no idea what that is.
The toll booth malfunction. Yep.
Yep. You just drive by and you go, "Oh shit, I was supposed to stop. I had no idea what that was." Can't find one of your guns. Getting a stick in the eye, or a black fly, or a wood chip, or whatever. chimney fire from punky wood.
Oh yeah.
Go down here. Let's see. Oh, people who grow up swimming naked and they don't even know what a bathing suit is.
Is that a personal story that you're telling us about, Brian? There.
No, I know it's happened to several kids where they're like, "Wait a minute, bathing suit? What's that? I've never even heard of that."
All right.
And then I guess I got one last one there.
All right. Let's
see. We got one last one here. We have too much freedom. We get used to it, and then when we travel, we occasionally scare people. All right.
It is a different place, isn't it, being here in Vermont compared to when you have to go elsewhere in the country, right?
Yeah, it gets a little tricky. You hit Massachusetts or Connecticut, and people are just used to, you know, being a big fish in a small pond. And you get down there, and people are like, "What the heck is this?"
Yeah. All right. And there's that thing called traffic that we rarely have to deal with. All right. Thanks, Brian. That's really great.
Have a good one.
All right. Vermont problems. If anyone would like to add to the list, sprayed by a skunk. I'm lucky. I've never been sprayed, nor have I had a dog that's been sprayed. But I think it happens more to your poor dog than it will to you. And when it happens, it's a bad, bad thing. And if anybody has, I don't know, do you bathe them in tomato juice, all the tomato juice that the local store will have? You're opening up cans of Bove sauce, doing everything, trying to sauce me, get that stench off the poor dog. The loon roast. We are going to talk about loons on Monday, they are protected, and I do love the loons. And I know Brian was having a little fun there, but the toll booth malfunction. Luckily, I come from away. I am a Flatlander, and have I actually worked in a toll booth one summer during college, so I'm pretty good at that. But don't send me out hunting. I'm the Flatlander who probably would shoot the old Buick. All right, let's go to Cabot next. We've got Michael. How you doing, Michael?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. What do you got for us today?
Well, I was sprayed by a skunk once.
Oh, here we go.
I was about 9 years old, and the skunk came. I went to use the restroom in the bathroom, middle of the night, woke up in the night, and there's a skunk in the bathroom chewing on the toilet paper. And I got sprayed, and I went to school the next day, and they sent me home early.
I bet. How long did you have that funk?
2 or 3 days. It was hard to get rid of, even with no hair, just the hair on my head, it hung around.
Well, I'll tell you a little story.
The dogs have it worse than we do.
I'll tell you a little story. This is the closest. So back when I had hair, back in the days, when I was in college, et cetera, beyond, I used to get my hair permed. And the first time I did, and I was working this job where, I was out on a truck all day. We were hauling stuff, and I'd be sweating. And they put this activator or something on it. And it has a certain smell. And 2 hours into my morning shift on this truck with this guy, and finally he looks at me and he says, "Man, do you smell a skunk? I've been smelling it all morning." And I had to point at my head and say, "It's my head." Because the stuff they use for perms smells skunky, and with the sweat, it was pretty pungent. So I probably smelled like the 9-year-old you.
I debated going to school that day, but I got told I needed to go to school. I probably rode my bike to school, I believe, that day, and I still stunk by the time I got there. So.
Oh, man. All right, Michael, thanks for sharing that.
All right. Yeah, have a good day.
All right, you too. I want to mention this for anyone who's headed to Fenway this season. When I did go down on Thursday, I showed up with, it's not a big bag, but I had my Merce, my man purse, as I take into the park. And they said, "You can't bring that in." And there's a restriction this year, and it's probably future years, but just keep this in mind. You might want to go to the Sox website. You can take a bag in no larger than 9 inches by 5 inches. So pretty much a clutch. And you either have to toss your bag, or there's a truck where you go and, you put it in a locker for $10. Now, they're making cash, but the other thing is you have to wait after the game. On what can be a half hour wait to get your bag back. So I had to leave a little early. Thank goodness it was a blowout. I went out to the truck early to get my bag, but, plan ahead, look at the restrictions. Probably don't want to take a big bag into, Fenway, when you go down for a game. All right. We're going to head back to the phones. We got Steven waiting for us in Montpelier. Hi, Steven. Go right ahead.
Hi, Rick. I have a bit of trivia. Your ad just mentioned, ice cream sandwiches.
Mm-hmm.
And when people are stressed, they tend to eat ice cream and sweets.
Right.
And to take off the tension. And something, a bit of trivia I learned, is that that's actually a dessert. And stress spelled backwards spells dessert.
Stressed. Oh, stressed. Yeah, dessert. Desserts. Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's fantastic. Oh, Stephen, that's brilliant. Yeah, so when you're stressed and you're forced to reach for a dessert like those wonderful ice cream sandwiches down at the Warren store, you're just doing basically what linguistics tells you to do. I love it. All right. Thanks, Stephen.
Great.
I can't believe I've lived my whole life and didn't know that till today, but I'm going to live by those words. We're headed to Barry. Tara's next. Hi, Tara. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you a quick remedy for if you're sprayed by a skunk or if your dog is sprayed by a skunk. It's hydrogen peroxide. So it's a quart of hydrogen peroxide, just the regular strength, which is 3%, a fourth cup of baking soda, and 1 to 2 teaspoons of liquid dish soap. And what that does is the hydrogen peroxide oxidizes the chemical that makes the smelly stuff in the skunk spray. So when you put it on, you know, your dog or yourself, it's really, really smelly for about like a couple of minutes, because what that's doing is it's oxidizing all of the layers of smell of that spray. And the reason why skunk spray is so hard to get rid of is because you'll wash it off and you'll wash the top layer off, but what will happen is then you'll expose another layer, and it's as that chemical gets oxidized, that's what smells. So anyway, so that's the trick. A quart of 3% hydrogen peroxide.
Now don't sign off too quickly. Yeah, let's give everybody slowly the recipe to get that off.
Okay, it's a quart of hydrogen peroxide. And that's usually like a 3% strength, like your normal kind of medical grade. A fourth cup of baking soda and 1 to 2 teaspoons of liquid dish soap.
All right. Isn't hydrogen peroxide?
So the risk is that you might bleach your pet a little bit.
Yeah, and I thought, didn't we used to do that back in the day to lighten our hair? We used hydrogen peroxide.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think it does sometimes. I've done it to a black dog, and he didn't really do anything to him. So I think if I'd left it on for a long time, it would have been a problem. But yes, it could cause something to get a little lighter, like your hair, if you use it on your hair or something.
Yeah. All right, and I love that you've explained scientifically why poor Michael over in Cabot, had to go back 3 days. It took him to get the stink of the skunk off after the funk of the skunk, because he was just washing the top layer off each time. And wow. All right.
I was sprayed by a skunk when I was an adolescent, and you know how adolescent girls are so self-conscious. So it was deeply scarring. When I found this remedy, I like to publicize it to the whole world so that nobody has to go through what I went through as a 12-year-old girl smelling a skunk all summer.
Oh my gosh, that skunk was on the loose. Where were you in Barrie at the time?
Actually, no, I was in Rhode Island, but I've been in Vermont for 25 years, and I've had my multiple sprays of all of my dogs. Thank God, not me here, but. Yep.
Yeah. All right. Great advice. If you see a skunk, what now that you've been sprayed, what do you do? Back away slowly. Run the other way.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Right.
I'm terrified of them.
All right, Tara. Thanks so much. All right.
Thank you.
All right. There it is. A quart of hydrogen peroxide, a quarter cup of baking soda, 1 or 2 teaspoons of dishwashing liquid. Hey, if your dog comes out a little lighter for it, that's all right. It'll be smelling like a good old dog scent in no time. And we talked about Dog Mountain today. Great place to take your dog up in St. Jay. So when you're in St. Jay, you head out Route 2 East out of town. It's, I think, right before the old scale company that's there. You'll take a left. You'll see the sign, Dog Chapel. And drive a couple miles up that road, and you get to Dog Mountain. Your dog will be very, very happy. All right. Still have time for one more call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can talk about Vermont problems like Brian and Eden did. He had a nice list of 9 things. Punky Wood, that was one. My dad was a scoutmaster, and he could not abide. I mean, if the Boy Scouts were out on a desert island and they just used their last match, if they used green wood, they used punky wood that was causing smoke, he would just kick the fire apart, and that would be it. He couldn't abide that. And Brian, disciple of my father's, that's a Vermont problem. So well done. Stick in the eye, black fly in the eye, anything in the eye, be careful. I didn't get all of his. I was trying to write down as many as possible. I think the one that really has resonated with people is being sprayed by a skunk. All right, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Let me see if anybody emailed vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, looks like that's clear right now. And we are close, okay? So I don't know if we're going to get anybody to sneak in before the end. Oh, maybe one. Let's see what we got. All right, Ray is calling us, and we're going to try to sneak Ray in. Ray, hey, you got to be quick. What do you got for me, Ray?
many, many years ago, my wife and I, when we were young, we had 2 children.
Mm-hmm.
We went out one night, and we came home, and, of course, we neglected to turn the outside light on. And we had a cat, and we always fed it on the porch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I came walking up on the porch and went to go in the front door, and the cat was in my way. So I just took my foot and shoved her out of the way. Walked in, turned the outside light on. And my wife came to the foot of the stairs, and she says, hollered at me. I said, what's the matter? I looked on the porch, and you know what I kicked?
Oh, I know now. Smelly Ray.
Believe it or not, it never sprayed.
No kidding.
It never sprayed. Needless to say, we stopped feeding the cat on the porch.
Oh, man, Ray. I hope you bought a lottery ticket that night. All right. Great story. Thanks for finishing off in a great way, in the pike position. All right, Ray. Ray can just get the skunk out of the way, and they will not spray Ray. Sounds good. All right, we've used up all our data for today. We're going to hop out for a CBS News break, and then when we get back, we'll spend the next hour getting to know the guy who has taught us so much about the Civil War and Vermont's role in it. Historian Howard Coffin will be here. And this afternoon on WDEV, we have Red Sox baseball. They wrap up that series, the rubber game of the match with the Angels out in Anaheim. Coverage begins at 3:07, first pitch at 4:07. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Howard Coffin has written 4 books about the Civil War, and he has given countless talks sharing what he has learned about the war, and specifically the role many Vermonters have played in it. He's also written Guns Over the Champlain Valley, focused on the Revolutionary War. But there's much more to his life, and Howard has now realized that, and he's working on his memoir. So today, rather than discussing the role others have played, we're going to learn about the role Howard Coffin has played in public information, the media, and in politics. Howard Coffin joins me now to finally talk about Howard Coffin. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
It's nice to be here. It's nice to be back in the world.
Isn't it great?
Yes.
I think you're maybe my 5th in-studio guest, and it is really great to have people to talk to. Listeners, if you've got a question for Howard about his time working at UVM or Dartmouth, at the Rutland Herald, or for Senator Jim Jeffords, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Howard, since it's a memoir, let's start out where you grew up and what Vermont was like at that time.
I grew up in Woodstock. And if you know anything about Woodstock today, it's kind of an upper class town.
But yeah.
We grew up without any money, but we were happy as the dickens. I had a twin brother and a sister 7 years younger, born on our seventh birthday. So,
oh my gosh,
we had wonderful childhoods, and I wasn't much of a student at Woodstock High School, and the only college I could get into was Lyndon Teachers College.
Oh, no kidding!
Yeah, I went up there and didn't last. Never graduated.
Well, when you were in high school, did you have an idea of what you were going to do, what that career path was
going
to be?
Yeah, I was a sports nut.
Ah.
Yeah, and I was a fair athlete, but I didn't get along with the coach very well, so I didn't play much.
In what sport?
Oh, I played baseball. I was a good baseball player, basketball. We didn't have soccer. I wish we had. I was too small for football.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was about it. And, it was a beautiful place to grow up, Woodstock. Vermont was so beautiful.
Yeah.
Much more beautiful then than it is now because,
Less development.
The farms, the fields.
Right.
We're 80% trees now. We were 80% fields then.
And that's true.
Oh, yeah. It was a wonderful place to grow up, and I had a great childhood.
Of course, a lot of the trees were removed for the sheep industry in the 1800s, right?
That's right. That's right, which kind of coincides with the Civil War.
That's right. Oh, yeah. So we needed that wool to make uniforms for the troops, right?
Well, yes, and they came in before the Civil War, the sheep did, but they certainly came in handy during the war.
So you thought you were a sports nut, but that couldn't have been a career with your size. You're probably like me. You kind of knew at some point, I'm never going to play pro ball, even though I'd love to.
No, but that. I did a lot of sports writing in high school. And I thought about becoming a sports writer, and I thought about possibly coaching or teaching. Mm-hmm. And so off to Lyndon State Teachers College I went.
Yeah, and how was it there? What were you majoring in, and what was the plan?
I was up there not really knowing what I was going to do. I started to major in history because there was a great history teacher there, mm-hmm. Graham Newell, who was the best history teacher in Vermont, and he fascinated me. But I didn't do well in math or science and so forth, and my junior year, everything was falling apart. I had my first hour of practice teaching, which I hated. And that night I had a couple of beers. It was 10 below, and I packed my cardboard suitcase and went out on Route 5 and stuck out my thumb, and that was the end of my college career. I hitchhiked home.
Wow. And did you go back to work on the farm? I know you enlisted or you served in the military.
I went to work at the Woodstock Inn where I'd worked summers. And I became a bell captain.
Not bad.
Last one at the old Woodstock Inn. And then I got drafted.
Oh, you got drafted.
I got drafted, yes.
What year was that?
64.
Okay.
Vietnam was heating up. I got drafted and did basic at Fort Dix and got sent to Fort Hood, Texas.
Mm.
And they trained me as a medic. I was headed for Nam.
Wow.
Yeah.
And?
What happened? I wormed my way onto the Post newspaper.
Fort Hood, Texas. Writing. Yeah, all of a sudden that writing comes into a little bit handy.
It was a 50,000 circulation newspaper. There were 50,000 troops at Fort Hood. And it was the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And that newspaper office was filled. There were reporters from the L.A. Times, the Philadelphia Daily News, San Francisco Chronicle, AP, UPI, and it was a godsend for me because I learned journalism.
Wow.
Then I became the star reporter.
Oh, I love this.
And they canceled my orders to Vietnam 5 times. I was raiding to save my life.
Oh, I love
it. None of us wanted to go to Vietnam.
You know, I just read a wonderful book by a Vermonter. It's called A Quiet Cadence. It's a novel, but set on his time in Nam. And I was a kid during the 60s, so
sure.
I viewed it from, you know, the footage that was shown on CBS Nightly News, Walter Cronkite, every night. That's how I saw Vietnam. and to read this book and to understand what our soldiers went through on the ground, the infantry, it scares me. And I'm so glad that you were spared.
I was fortunate because a sergeant told me I was a towhead. I had blonde hair, and he said you wouldn't last a week in Vietnam, yeah. And I would have been a medic or perhaps a machine gunner. I had some training in machine gunning, which wouldn't have been good either.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of my 2 years drafting, you know, the commanding general called me in, and I was getting out in a week. And he said, Specialist Coffin, we want you to sign up for 6 more years in this man's army.
Oh my God.
And I said, thank you, sir. I'm going home to Vermont. I got a newspaper job. He said, no, we're going to make you an offer you can't refuse. And this was clever. They had done their research. You know what they offered me? 6 years I'd sign, and I would go to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, as an aide to Dwight Eisenhower.
Oh, my gosh.
I thought about it, but I said, no, I don't think so. And he said, think about it overnight. I did, went back and told him no thanks. And he said, good luck, Coffin. And off I went to the Rutland Herald.
Well, we're going to get to that. I'm just going to throw out a quick Dwight Eisenhower story. In his biography, he went to West Point, played football there, and in one game they were playing Carlisle, and you had Jim Thorpe on one side and Dwight D. Eisenhower playing on the other side. Incredible, you know, what history threw together at that moment on that Saturday afternoon, right, in college
football. I guess so.
Pretty wonderful. Hey, let's take a call. We've got Mike joining us from Northfield. Mike, go right ahead.
I just was listening, and he mentioned that he was drafted. Well, I was drafted in 67, mm-hmm. and I spent 69 with the 25th Infantry in Vietnam.
Wow.
And I tell you the truth, it was not fun.
Yeah.
I didn't leave anything there that I want to go back for.
Yeah. How long were you over there?
You know, even in 60, in 64 and 5, most of us didn't want to go. We weren't sure that the war was anything we should have been involved in. But some of the guys I went through basic with and was in a medical battalion with for a while did go, and a couple of them never came home. Yeah. They got killed. Sad thing.
Wow. Yeah. How long were you there, Mike?
I had all of 69.
Wow.
And while I was there, I put 28 of my buddies on helicopters who were either wounded or killed.
Well, thanks for your call. Thank you so much for your service.
We got in a lot of firefights.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yep.
I was drafted. I did not want to go. But we all had to do our duty.
Yeah. Well, we're so glad that you were able to come back. Thanks so much, Mike. Wow. I had our hero in our neighborhood, Howard, was a guy named Joey Fry, and he was, you know, the high school football star, running back, drafted, sent over to Vietnam, and did not come home. And it left a mark on every one of us, all the kids in the neighborhood who looked up to him. So. Now you come back, you have that job, or you get out of the army, you have the job at the Rutland Herald.
That was a piece of luck too. My twin brother Bruce roomed at UVM with a guy named Tony Marrow.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony, was a reporter for the Rutland Herald. He later went on to win a Pulitzer at Newsday. And, Tony is a Rutland, you know, a Rutland family. And, they went to the Shrine game one day, Tony and Bruce and Ken Wilde, who was the editor of the Herald, and they stopped at my folks' house on the way home, and my mother told Ken Wilde very conveniently that there was another son and he was working for a newspaper, and Ken had a couple of beers, and he said, tell him he's got a job when he gets out.
Oh, my gosh.
I'll tell you, I've lived on luck.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. Let's take a quick break. Howard Coffin is my guest this hour, reliving, retelling some interesting parts of Vermont history, but not from the Civil War, rather from the 20th and 21st century in his interesting roles that he's had during that time. To chat with Howard, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Howard, we left off with you as a reporter at the Rutland Herald. Newspapers were a lot different than they are now. What was it like working at the Herald back then?
Well, it was a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We didn't make any money.
Right.
the managing editor was a guy named Kendall Wild, Ken Wild, who was the best newspaper man that Vermont has ever known. Mm. And he had an eye for talent, and he put together a terrific staff. And we worked all day. Some days I wrote 5, 6, 7 stories on a typewriter.
Right.
And we partied at night after the paper came out. And we were young and full of energy. And I started on the city desk as a general reporter. I became city hall reporter. And then I did some of my PU work. And then I became state reporter. I could wander anywhere I wanted to in the state.
Oh,
and I eventually became the political reporter of the Herald. And I just had a blast. Covered campaign after campaign, you know, and national conventions. And it just was terrific. I had so much fun. And I never thought I'd leave.
How long were you at the Herald?
12 years.
Wow, that's a good stretch.
Yeah. Yes.
Was there a biggest or most important news story that you covered that you can remember in those 12
years?
Well,
I suppose, generally speaking, the environmental movement in Vermont, I really promoted that and covered it. It was a remarkable time. I covered the licensing hearings at Vermont Yankee, which was important. I covered the Cog Railway wreck on Mount Washington and was the only reporter who got to the scene of the came back. I got a heck of a scoop there. A lot of big political stories, covered an awful lot of, major political figures. Got to know a lot of, you know, Dean Davis, Tom Salmon, Jim Jeffords.
Yeah.
Not only did he and I become friends, I rented his house for a couple of years.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes, and Jim was one of the best friends I ever had. There's more to that later.
But, yep, we'll talk about you working for Jim.
Yeah, I was a tough reporter. I got a lot of scoops, and I just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, things change.
Yeah, how does it feel to see – I mean, I worked at the Miami Herald I grew up, we would have three papers a day where I grew up.
Yes.
We had the morning paper from Allentown, Pennsylvania, the afternoon paper from Bethlehem,
yep.
And then my dad would bring the Philadelphia newspaper home, the Inquirer usually. So three newspapers a day we read. They were robust. There was tons. You see papers today that are holding on for dear life.
I think the Rutland Herald was the best small city newspaper in the country at the time I was there. Wildwood is an extraordinary guy. We had the best reporter I ever saw was a woman named Mavis Doyle, who we hired away from the Burlington Free Press. But we had a large group of very good newspaper people, and we covered the daylights out of Vermont, and we changed Vermont. Vermont changed markedly in the period that I was at the Rutland Herald. It liberalized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Rutland Herald was as big an influence on the state's change as any. It was a remarkable thing to see. And, you know, I was covering people who changed the state.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Hoff, you know, Tom Salmon. I mean, Dean Davis with the environmental movement, a Republican.
Yeah.
And at the same time I was working for the Herald for 6 years, I worked for the Christian Science Monitor.
Oh, wow.
Doing about 100 stories a year on Northern New England. So I was a busy lad, but
yeah.
I had to make money.
Well, tell us about that connection as a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. Very important publication. So what kind of things did you cover and how did that come
about? It was one of the great
about?
Papers in the world at
yeah.
the time. Well, I didn't know anything about Christian Science, and Mavis Doyle had that account, and she gave it to me. She was getting a little tired. Her health went. And so the monitor said, just send us the best story you've got and we'll see how you're doing. And so I sent him a story about an X-rated movie house in Hardwick. That story came back with more red ink on it than I had, and the editor, Leon Lindsay, said, come to Boston. I need to teach you about Christian Science. And he did, and he and I were friends for 6 years, and I worked for him for 6 years. Had a great time. Did a lot of reporting on Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
Right.
Yeah. And any good story that I could find in northern New England, they'd take and help my income.
Okay, so you really loved that era. I mean, the Rutland Herald, the Christian Science Monitor, you were at the Herald for 12 years.
Yes.
So what made you decide, okay, it's time for something else?
I also worked some for the Boston Globe. I also did some stuff for them. What happened was that the Rutland Herald unionized, and I was in a terrible position. I'd been there 12 years. Most of my old friends – at the paper were management. Mm. A lot of my sympathies were with labor.
Right.
So I was caught right in the middle. And just at that time, Dartmouth College called.
Right.
And asked me if I would come over and be assistant news director. And I said no. And I tried to stick it out at the Hero for a while longer. And didn't work. A month later, I called the news director and he said, you still want to come? And I said, yeah. He said, I'll jimmy the search. And I went to work at Dartmouth for 7 wonderful years.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And it was a remarkable experience. I must say that before I left the Herald, I had made some wonderful contacts in the news media, and that served me well in public relations.
Yeah, that is the switch. You're changing sides.
It's
some people would
switch.
Say you're selling out. You know, the media people would say, oh, he's going to be a flack over at Dartmouth College.
Absolutely.
But, what did you enjoy about that switch, that change of approach?
Well, there were a million things. It was tough to become a spokesperson. All my instincts are to be a news reporter.
Right.
There were so many things I liked. One of the things about Dartmouth was that they had a visiting writers program, and I got to know them all, and I became friends with a lot of them. Wow. I mean, John Updike, John Cheever, William Styron, Kurt Vonnegut. Vonnegut and I became friends. Oh. Carlos Fuentes, he and I were friends. Erskine Caldwell, Toni Morrison, Barbara Tuchman, Robert Penn Warren, Mary McCarthy, all these people I worked with, you know, had lunch with, and learned from them.
What little hair I had left just all dropped out.
Why? It was just a remarkable opportunity. Wow. A remarkable opportunity.
How outstanding.
And, an old editor at the Rutland Herald said to me once, he said, you really want to be a writer, don't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you know, you can't beat the first million words. I think I wrote him at the Rutland Herald, you know, but anything you can pick up. And another guy I met at Dartmouth who became a close friend of mine was Edward Connery Latham, who was Robert Frost's editor.
Oh, my.
And one of Robert Frost's best friends. And Latham edited a lot of the things that I wrote. And I had a great editor anyway at Dartmouth, a guy named Bob Graham, a Boston Herald guy. And so I was learning a lot all the time. And then I went on the road for Dartmouth. I was their major media man. Went to Boston, New York, Washington every month.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, met with CBS, NBC, got to know everybody, Corral, Rather, you know. And I had a blast, and I was single. Expense account, and I was just a cloud nine.
Oh, Howard.
Went to a lot of ball games, too.
Oh, yeah. What, old Senators games, maybe?
Well, a lot of Red Sox,
okay.
Yankees,
yeah.
Knicks, Celtics, Bruins.
Oh, boy.
You know, I'm a sports nut. And
we're going to get
to
you.
You know, I'm writing a book, and there's going to be a lot of what I saw in sports in that. And Williams, Homer, Pearsall make the great catches or score, you know, just.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, I've had a very good life.
Was there anything that happened at Dartmouth during that stretch that that stands out, that was that you're going to remember in the book?
You betcha. We Animal House, the movie, came out.
Oh, right.
Of course, was based on a Dartmouth fraternity.
Yeah.
And so the media came from far and wide. And then we had a big controversy over the Indian symbol.
Oh, right.
Dartmouth was the Dartmouth Indians.
Yes,
and
they were.
We had a liberal president. He dropped that. And the alumni rose up, and we had media come from all over the world.
Yeah.
One day, my boss was out of town. I had had two networks in town, and I stumbled back to the office at 7 o'clock at night. My secretary, she was wonderful. She said, I got back to the office, and she said, I'm sorry, there's one more reporter here. I walked into my office. There's this kind of scholarly-looking guy sitting in the corner. The phone rang. Another reporter, I finished the conversation. It was about 8 o'clock at night. I put down the phone. I said, yeah, can I help you? He said, you look tired. And I said, yeah, I am. I said, I'm Howard Coffin. He said, I'm Calvin Trillin.
Oh, my gosh.
Probably the best newspaper writer in the country, maybe in the world. And I said, Mr. Trillin, I'm going to open the window and jump. I was three stories up. He laughed like hell, and we got along fine, and he did the best story ever done on Dartmouth.
Oh, my gosh. Calvin Trillin's written a great story from back in the day on the game suppers in Vermont that I remember quite clearly.
Yes.
But, yeah, interesting. You know, people kind of think the name changes of Native American nicknames is more recent, but – Dartmouth and Stanford were two of the early ones to make changes. I was living in Oxford, Ohio, when Miami University switched from Redskins to Red Hawks. But, these were the first two, I think, Stanford and Dartmouth. We're going to take a break for an NBC, CBS News update. We're going to be back with historian Howard Coffin. Listeners, you can dial in 244-1777-877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. In my entire life, I've never known as many Howards as those that have made their mark in Vermont and beyond. I'm thinking of novelists Howard Frank Mosier and Howard Norman, Governor Howard Dean, and historian, reporter, and press secretary Howard Coffin. The latter of the Howards is my guest this hour, and we're hearing about his accomplishments for a change rather than him telling us about Civil War heroes. Listeners, to ask Howard about his career, maybe while working with Senator Jeffords, you can call us 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. We were last at Dartmouth. You switched from Dartmouth to UVM, I think, was your next move, right?
That's right. Dartmouth had a great president, John Kemeny. He made Dartmouth co-ed. He got rid of the Indian symbol. He brought Dartmouth into the 20th century. But he was liberal. A lot of the alumni were conservative, so they brought in a conservative president when he retired, David McLaughlin. And David McLaughlin and Howard Coffin didn't get along.
Oh, boy.
And I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew I wasn't going to be there much longer. And Tony Morrow's brother, Nick, and I had worked together at the Rutland Herald. He's still a dear friend, and he was public relations director at UVM. And he called me right at that time and said, would you come up here and be my news director? I packed my bag in a hurry.
And how long did you spend at UVM?
I stayed there 5 years, and I did their major media. I was a news director. You know, I oversaw the news operation, the alumni magazine. And then, I was on the road like I was at Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first got up there, they told me, you know, we want to increase our national image. And a new book had just come out called The Public Ivies.
Oh, right.
But UVM didn't want to publicize it. Their president, Laddie Core, didn't want to publicize it. He thought it would make UVM look snobbish. And I said to Laddie, I said, well, you might as well fire me because that's the best PR tool you're ever going to get.
Absolutely.
And they backed off and I went on the road and I pushed you the image up because I had the contacts and I had the media pouring it up there.
Oh,
I still had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
A lot of fun, a lot of good visiting professors and, a lot of good people, and I was on the road again, and I loved it.
I love that. All right, so at what point did you make the switch and become press secretary for Senator Jim Jeffords?
Well, Jeffords came to me, took me out to dinner. Now, I had known Jeffords. I'd covered him. He always complained because he said I was too tough on him, but I was tough on all of them, you know.
All right.
But he said he wanted me to become his press secretary. I said, I don't want to go to Washington. And he said, well, you're going to have to come down here at least and get and learn the job.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, okay, I'm going to level with you. He said, I'm not really interested in you being my press secretary. I want to leave the Senate at some point, come back to Vermont and run for governor. And I want you to get me elected governor of Vermont. You know Vermont as well as anybody.
Wow.
And I said, that sounds good. Why do you want to be governor of Vermont? He said, I want to pass a state land use plan. And I said, God bless you, Jim. I've been trying to get that done. I will do it. And so off I went to Washington. Didn't like it very much down there, but I learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And after about 6 months, I came back and worked in Montpelier. Yeah, the job was all right. I didn't kind of fit in with the staff because nobody knew what my secret mission was, you know. But I was off around the state making contacts and everything. And then a doctor told me I might not live too long with a heart problem.
You?
Yeah.
Wow.
And
that was
okay,
how long
I went
ago?
To Jim and I said, Jim, I want to write some books. I'm going to quit. Jefford says, you're not leaving me till you've been on the payroll 5 years, so you get a retirement. But he cut me down to 5, 4, 3, 2 in 1 day. He was wonderful.
Incredible.
And I started writing my first book on the Civil War.
All right. Now, don't leave us hanging. What happened with the dream of being governor of Vermont?
Jim decided to stay one more term in Washington. And by the time that term was over, he had serious Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And he couldn't do it. He would have been a tremendous governor of Vermont. I would have left my writing career to go back and help him pass that land use plan. We better have one here soon because there are going to be millions of people coming into this state as the globe warms. This is the place to go, you know.
Right.
But Jeffords was a great man. He showed it when he left the Republican Party. He was a great environmentalist. He was just and as good a friend as I ever had.
Were you working with him for him when he made that switch to become an independent?
No, but he consulted with me about it.
Yeah.
And I was pushing him years before that to go into to become a Democrat because the Republicans weren't treating him well.
Hmm.
But he felt a loyalty to the party. His father had been a big time, you know, Republican and so forth. He wouldn't budge. But finally, Bush and the Speaker of the House made him so mad that he did go.
Yeah. And explain to people, you know, who don't really quite know the difference between a Vermont Republican and a national Republican, because there is a pretty.
Well, it's all changed now.
Right.
But Jeffords was a moderate Republican,
mm-hmm.
and in some areas, liberal.
Right.
Certainly in terms of environmental controls and human rights and so forth like that. Vermont Republicans were pretty darn moderate, and they still are compared to most of them, compared to the way the party's gotten today. Jeffords would not be an independent today. He would be a Democrat,
mm-hmm.
no question about it.
And what was his idea for the land use plan for the state?
A map. You see, when Act 250 was passed, it was supposed to be a state land use plan as part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But Davis, who was a conservative Republican, got Act 250 passed, but he couldn't bring himself to go that extra step. And gotcha. Jeffords knew he should have. So there would have been a map that said this is where development should go, this is where it shouldn't, to keep the state looking and being the way it is. Mm-hmm. It needs to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So you worked down to one day a week, and then you finished there and then started writing books. But before we get to that, I do want to talk. I know you're a massive sports fan, as you've mentioned. I've run into you and Steve Zind, formerly of VPR and The Point, at basketball games around the state, college basketball games. And so I want to talk a little bit about your sports interest. First of all, big Sox fan, and you got to see the great Ted Williams play. So tell us about that.
I saw Williams in four games. I saw him hit two home runs. One of them that was right after he came back from Korea, a pinch hit, and hit a home run off Herb Score. Wow. He owned Score. He had a 400-plus career average off him. I saw Jim Bunning's no-hitter at Fenway Park. I saw Roberto Clemente stretch a single into a double up at Jerry Park. I saw Reggie Jackson almost hit one out of Yankee Stadium. I saw Bobby Orr as a rookie. I saw Rocket Richard at Boston Garden.
Oh, the Garden.
You know, Jean Béliveau. Dryden, you know. Basketball, I saw Bird and Maravich and Russell. I saw Russell play Chamberlain. I mean, I am a sports nut, and I go – you know, ordinarily I go to 40, 50 basketball games a year in Vermont.
Right.
Not just college.
Oh.
High school, too.
Oh, do you really?
Middlebury. Oh, I love it. St. Michael's, absolutely.
So how – I know. I've seen you at St. Michael's. I've seen you at VTC over at Middlebury. So how's this past year been for you?
Awful. No, actually not.
Don't hold back, Howard.
I learned an awful lot this last year about the Civil War. I've been reading and reading, but I became a nut about European soccer.
There we go.
I love European soccer, and I watch it all the time. It's my favorite sport now.
I'm a big Everton fan.
And, of course, I'm England. A Bruins fan, although they screwed up their goaltending this year.
Yeah.
And,
have you been watching Euro 2020?
Absolutely.
All right.
So. Absolutely. And Britain plays this, England plays this afternoon against Denmark.
Right.
And if they win, they play Italy in the final on Sunday. And, you know, at Wembley, you know.
Yeah, that's
I'm
right.
Fired up about that.
Should be exciting. Wembley is where England last won the World Cup 1966, but it's been a drought ever since. The Italians in Euro 2020 have been very surprising. They've had a difficult row for a few years. Now they look like they're seriously on point, beating Spain yesterday in a penalty kick shootout at the end of the match. Howard, we left you at UVM, I'm sorry, with Senator Jeffords, and you really wanted to write about the Civil War. So, you know, first of all, where did your interest in Civil War history come from?
I just grew up with it. My mother remembered her grandfather, who was in the 9th Vermont Regiment, and I just grew up hearing Civil War stories. And when I was 4 years old, I was asking her to get me Civil War books out of the library. And the librarian said, no, he's too young. But my mother told her a thing or two, and she read me a lot of books on the Civil War. It's always been in me.
Do you remember the first Civil War battlefield that you visited?
Oh, absolutely. Gettysburg, 1967. And I've been going to battlefields ever since. I would read all winter long about the Civil War, focus on some battle, figure it all out, and then I got 1 week's vacation from the Herald, and I'd take that week and go south and walk that battlefield. And boy, did I learn the Civil War.
Oh, my. Let's take this call from Stephen, who's joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to mention, years ago when I first started to work for the state of Vermont, I believe Rick Carbon was the executive director of the Vermont Land Trust. And I believe he worked with Dean Davis to help start Act 250.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, they had Act 250 had passed, and they decided to develop comprehensive land use plans. And one day, Bernie Johnson, who was a state planner, took me into the basement of the pavilion, and there were all of these comprehensive land use plans. And I believe that concept fell out of favor, and all of those plans were destroyed.
Wow.
Well, they were going down that road, I know. And I think Davis was a little too conservative, and he started getting a lot of pressure from a lot of Republican fans, and I think he kind of chickened out. Davis was a basically decent human being, though.
Well, interesting, though, that the plans were there.
They were there, yeah.
Just all ready to be launched, but just couldn't pull the trigger.
Jeffords would have done it.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, so Civil War, the Gettysburg battlefield was the first, and you've been to probably hundreds since then, I would imagine. And
I've been to an awful lot, yes. And one of the things that I did with Jeffords, I went to a couple of seminars in Virginia on the Civil War, and I met some of the best historians, and they were forming an organization to save the battlefields because the battlefields were being destroyed by the unregulated development.
Right.
And I wanted to help. I said, is there anything I can do? And they said, we don't have any connections in Congress. We need Congress. And now this was before I went to work for Jeffords, but I said, maybe I can help you.
Mm.
And I got Jeffords involved, and he got millions of dollars and saved. He's the biggest, I think, legislative presence in Civil War battlefield preservation history. And I subsequently went on the big boards of preservation, and we just saved a tremendous amount of battlefields.
Oh, that's outstanding.
Oh, it was wonderful. Dear Jim.
Yeah. Now, it's a big jump, though, from having an interest, reading all those
yeah.
years, seeing those battlefields, to saying, okay, I'm going to start writing books about the Civil War. So, you know, what got you motivated? What finally, you know, got you in front of that typewriter? Maybe it was by then a computer and started writing.
I had an idea about writing a book on telling the story of Vermont through a book on Civil War places in Vermont that, you know, still exist.
Mm-hmm.
I took that idea to Countryman Press, which was in Woodstock.
Right.
The managing editor was a guy named Peter Jennison. We became great friends. I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, what you really want to do, Howard, is write a history of Vermont in the Civil War, but you don't quite dare. If you'll do that, we'll publish it.
Oh, my.
And I did. Well, I had a problem. I had left Jeffords' employment, or I was cutting way down on it, you know, and I was short of money. Happened to go to Boston one day. I'm an autograph collector, you know, and I went into Goodspeed's bookstore in Boston, and I found a Robert E. Lee autograph. I looked at it, looked interesting to me, $11,000. My God.
Whoa.
I went off to the Boston Symphony concert. A friend of mine worked there, and at intermission, the thought hit me. That's not just any Lee document. That's his farewell to the Confederate troops at Appomattox.
Oh, my God.
I went back to Goodspeed's. There was every autograph dealer in New England was in there. But the elderly lady who ran autographs had forgotten to put it on display. I bought it, sold it for about 8 times what I paid for it, and that financed my first 2 books.
Oh, Howard.
God, Robert E. Lee looked down on me.
Isn't that incredible?
And it was absolutely incredible. It was a great stroke of good luck.
Robert E. Lee's autograph
and then,
finances.
Absolutely. And then I'm still working for Jeffords when my first book came out. It's a hit. I'm traveling through Franklin County. We go to the fair up there. Jim and I get out of the car, and there's a huge crowd of people, and they surge towards us, and they all want to shake my hand. Jeffords says, you should run for something. He didn't like it.
Did you ever consider entering politics?
Was yes. That ever, yeah. I was approached about it a couple of times, yeah, about running for the legislature. And then there were some people who wanted me to run for lieutenant governor. But I don't have the patience. It takes, you know, legislative is all committee meetings.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just have to throw the rest of your life pretty much away. And I don't have the patience for that. I've got too many things going.
Yeah.
But I kind of – sometimes I wish I'd done it. I don't know.
So you're writing your memoir now.
Yes.
Are there any other Civil War books in you that you're thinking, oh, I still –
Yeah, I don't think one. I'll get them done, and I'm having a very hard time writing this book, which is two-thirds done, because I've had a writer's block since my dear wife Sue died.
Oh.
It's a very – it was a real blow to me. She was the dearest human being I ever knew. And I hope I – maybe things like this will get me rolling.
Right.
I'm back on the speaking circuit again. By the way, out there, I'm ready to go if anybody's interested.
Yeah, tell people about that. You do a lot of talks and
a lot,
you are
– a lot through the Humanities Council. They've been wonderful to me for more than 20 years. And I've got – although all the requests are coming in, I've got – I Good. Think five scheduled now, and there'll be more. I'm speaking now on Vermont women in the Civil War. And the year 1800 and froze to death. I'm speaking about that.
Oh, right.
And I'm giving a talk in Bellows Falls, the first of part of August, on the Vermont General Lewis Addison Grant, who the troops called Aunt Lydia. So things are looking up.
So how was the pandemic year? Pretty much all that went away, or did you do any streaming talks?
Well, no, I didn't. Yeah. I don't like those. Yeah. I want to be in front of my audience.
I get that.
A lot of reading, a lot of soccer, a lot of washing hands. I'm still wearing my mask because I haven't had a cold for 15 months.
Oh, my.
And for somebody who's in his 80th year, that's pretty good.
Absolutely. Yeah, we did learn quite a bit from the wearing the mask, the social distancing, the washing of hands. The flu season was non-existent, which was a positive thing. So maybe
absolutely
we'll keep those things up. And well, you got to get back to that book. You got to finish it. People want to hear these stories, not just in the hour that we had today, but to read the book, Howard.
Well, there's a lot more.
All right, good. All right, Howard Coffin, author of 9 books, and he's working on the 10th. That is his memoir. And you can learn about his writings and at howardcoffin.wordpress.com. Best place to send people.
Howard Coffin at Comcast.net is the best place.
Okay. All right. And Howard, just
or just call me in Montpelier. I'm in the phone
book. All right. This is Vermont.
That's
but
right.
You can also hire him through Vermont Humanities. You'll find him there as well. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan and produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Willow Zartarian. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.